Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Echoes. I'm Paula Schiller, and today we'll learn a little more about the Inupiaq language from Edna McLean of the Alaska Native Language Center. Then we'll hear parts of a story in Inupiaq and in English. The story is called The Ten-Legged Polar Bear in English. In Inupiaq, it's called
Kupkuwak. And
how would you spell that in English?
It's spelled in English Q-U-P-Q-U-G-I-A-Q.
Let me try that.
And that G has a dot over it, which is basically an Inupiaq symbol. Okay. Kupkuwak.
Do it again.
Kupkuwak.
Kupkuwak?
Yeah, you have to start further down your throat.
Kupkuwak. Kupkuwak.
Uh-huh, right there. And if you're looking for words, like if you wanted to focus on what the main verb was, you'd find these endings like tok and duak. You'd focus on those endings with a K or a T or a Q. When he's using the Q, ka, ending, then he's talking about one individual, and that's basically, there's one actor in this story along with the Kupkuwak, the ten-legged polar bear. When he's using the T, dot, then he's voicing opinion of some storyteller or some what people used to think. And you'll also hear a lot of the of these endings, which we call subordinative endings, and there's hlugu, hluni, you know, and those are used to modify the action that is being done, or to describe the what the polar bear might be doing, like bangalik hluni. Okay, that would translates into running. Okay, and especially in one of these pages, we go into where the man is trying to lose the polar bear after he, injures him, you know, by popping his eyes with his spear. The man injures the polar bear, and then he's trying to lose the polar bear by making his tracks go different directions, because the polar bear can't see him and he's following him by smell. So he'd go slower by trying to sniff something that was going in this direction.
In a windy path.
In a windy path, right. Mm. So that would be described by one of the endings of hluni. Sakurach hluni akbatuk angun. You know, the man is running in a winding pattern. So
it's a much more economical language than English, it seems.
It's a beautifully structured language. It's very regular, and you see the beauty of it more in the relationships of the different dialects of Inupiaq, like from Barrow to Seward Peninsula. For instance, if we wanted to say Tupik, which means tent in Barrow, in Seward Peninsula they'd go Tuvik, where the P softens to a V, and there's some beautiful regular patterns going on between the dialects.
The story we'll hear is a famous one in the Barrow area. It's told by Floyd Avakana and will be translated by his granddaughter, Dorcas Rock. Both are shortened versions.
Tavanit, Siku puktak pag kupakaktuak ilisimaglugo.
Napahayog mo.
Napahayog tunan niya. Puktanak lo kupakaktuak inaito mo. Uno pa masiliklo ni. Asi kamnatiyang kapitlo ni. Dahil na timig tam na ilisimaglugo. Anak siya ako gilugo, isimoglo ni, nikpakayak si maga. Tadwai tayo na nikpaktilugo. Nikpalang me, taap sumani, ilo si maga luang nga, tayo netimun at lugo tila nga, nikpa pisapiyak lo ni, nikpa kiyotimara. Ilo, Taiko ilisimagat tainati walua kuwangnik puktarawa kakuruko adlubilua. Ilisimagaluangan nikpakiutimagat.
It's been a from a lot of people, and then I've heard it from people from Barrow, from Wainwright, from all over. Kivalina? And then it started out long time ago. It was quite a ways out from Barrow. And then Qilawittaq is the name of that place. And also the other name is or Milwittaq. It's in one of those two places that where it's in, right in between these two places where these people used to live. And there was this one man that knew. I've heard of that ten-legged polar bear, and he went out hunting, and then he knew of this story about the ten-legged polar bear, and so he knew about that polar bear that had ten legs. So he went over there and decided to find it. You know, he wanted to look for it, and so he went to that place where this ten-legged polar bear always went to, and wanted to find a place where he could trap this, you know, bear. And then he's heard of this place where this ice, where it was real sharp, where it became real fat, and then it ended up where it was real narrow. So that's where he wanted to go. That's where he decided to trap this bear. And, you know, it was real sharp, you know, where we went to. And he knew that it was real narrow, and that was the only place of that ice where he knew of, and that's where he wanted to go and trap this ten-legged polar bear. And while he was there, he knew that the polar bear would be there, but he pretended not to know. So he really wanted to get that polar bear. And he started to let him run after him, or, you know. And then when the polar bear went in, you know, went out from the water, and when he seen him, when the polar bear seen him, and then, you know, he was really going after the polar bear, and he really wanted to get him. So he got this, his knife, and he popped this polar bear's ice. And then he started running after him, you know, and then he was even trying to climb up on top of the ice, and it cracked up. Because when it finally got on top of the ice, he could smell the trail of that man, so he started going after him, you know. He started going after him, and then he knew it. You know, this is how this man went. So he started zigzagging and zigzagging so that this polar bear could tell that, you know, he didn't want him to catch him. And then in a way, he wanted to. He wanted him to be confused. And then every time he reached it where he'll run away from him a little bit. Every time he get to the places where he was zigzagging, he run away from him. But he wanted to take him to this place where he could get him cornered, you know, get this 10-legged polar bear cornered. And then he finally reached it. Just before he reached it, this man went to this place where he could trap the polar bear. And he went in there. And then when he went in there, he waited until he could make some. He made it himself nice and comfortable so that he could get ready to kill this polar bear when he got stepped in through these two cracks. And he waited for him. And then that scent of him was so strong that the polar bear really went after him, and he got stuck. And then when he got stuck on there, he went in back of him. He climbed up, went in back of him, and killed him.
The Ten-Legged Polar Bear, a story from the Alaska Native Oral Literature Project. Fortune of Echoes, I'm Paula Schiller. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage, how things are and how they got that way. Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
This is Chinook Patterns, and I'm Paula Schiller. At last fall's AFN convention, time was devoted to a Native Women's Task Force. It was resolved then to bring representatives of all Native women from all over the state together this spring to discuss Native women's issues and to make recommendations for possible solutions to their problems. Georgiana Lincoln was involved in the Women's Coalition. She is director of Native Services of the Tenenbaum Chiefs Conference, and she is on the boards of several service and Native organizations. I asked her if Native women's issues were the same as women's issues in general, or do Native women have special concerns?
I'm glad that you bring up, you know, what are the women, the Native issues, and not just women issues, because I think we are talking about two different things.
Oh.
One is when we talk about, you know, women's issues broadly, that for Native women's issues, it's way down the ladder even yet, because for Native people on the whole, we have yet to identify to resolve the issues for Native people.
As a minority.
Including, yes. Over and above any other issues. So then when we talk about the Native women's issues,
that has a lower priority?
Not priority for us, but I think that women's issues across the board, if you look at it that way, we haven't yet resolved a lot of those for our total Native population, you know, much less our Indian women. So we have, I think, a lot more of a fight on our hands than maybe the total overall women's issues. Of course we have the employment and housing and education and all of those things, but I think that the magnitude is much more stronger than a non-Native, I think, for the women. The Indian women in the past years, and not too long ago, the old BIA thrust was for the men, when they come in, they want higher education, well, or vocational. We didn't even get into higher education, but vocational technical training. It was the old welding school, mechanics school. You know, that was the first thing that popped into their head. And for the women, it was automatically clerical and hairdressing. Sure. And there wasn't, well, what would you like to be? A lot of our Indian women are presently almost like doctor's assistants, you know, out there in the villages. We have a few men, too. But there's no reason why they can't go on to be doctors. You know, they've got a lot of the background and experience already. They just don't have that schooling, that diploma.
Or the idea in their heads that they could be, maybe.
Right. Exactly. And we're now trying to tell the men and women, but especially the women, hey, look, you know, it's wide open. And if you want to be a doctor, lawyer, or Indian chief, we're going to help you to do that. And there's a lot of opportunities for women right now, too, you know, the Indian women. But then when we talk about education or we talk about employment and our people are out in the bush, then we get back to, well, if they leave, who's going to care for the family? You know, the children, who's going to care for the child or children while they are either in school or working? Historically, our men have been out there, you know, getting the paychecks. And in the past, that's where the education and training was, you know, gearing our men to be the chief providers. And so it becomes a problem for the women to leave the village. You know, when you and I sit here in Fairbanks and we talk about education, it's just hop in the car or get on the bus and go up to the University of Alaska. When you're in Huslia and you're talking about education, it's either you leave your family or you bring your family with you, and you have all these multiple problems in an urban area, and the kids adjusting to the school. Or you stay in the village and you try and get some kind of a training, like they have the XSEED for teachers right now, and get it through correspondence. We know that our education is not up to par yet in the villages, and we are trying to build that up. In employment, it is, there's so few jobs out there in the villages that, again, historically, you know, we've said that the men have been the ones to provide. So the women, when they're aggressive and they go out for a job, especially a key position, I don't think yet that the villagers have accepted the idea that, you know, women can get these key positions even within the village, and the men, you know, they then become the breadwinner, if you will, for their family.
But does changing it around and having more women being the providers and having the higher paying and more important jobs, that implies a whole turnover in tradition that may or may not be a good thing?
I'm not so sure it does. You know, I've really given that an awful lot of thought. And for the Native people, the women have always been the supportive group for our leaders, quote-unquote. And I think that the women historically have been the decision-makers. You know, they were part of the decision-making process, but the men were the ones to relay that decision. So I think that maybe even more in the Native culture, the women did have leadership roles to play. But with society as it is today, that they've said, you know, that is not our role. And now that's changing again.
The idea of a woman being an Indian chief is not really so foreign either. I think some of the, at least now, the corporation village presidents and many of the higher positions on the corporations are held by women.
I think we're getting there. Yeah, I don't think it's foreign. I remember probably about 5 years ago, there were rumors that I was going to try for the president of Tana Chiefs, and I'll never forget one of the leaders, and a long time leader, a native man from one of the villages came up to me and he asked if this was true, and it was not true. But he asked me, is this true that you are going to be try and get the president of Tana Chiefs and get that position? And I said, why do you ask? And he said, there has never been a chief for the Tana Chiefs, a president, a woman president, and as long as I live, there never will be. And I just kind of laughed, and I thought, well, I'll play along with this game for a while. And I said, yes, I am going to put my name in the hopper. I've been approached by it, and so I think I will. It's time for a woman. Never, never. And he was very adamant about that. And I think maybe that is changing. There's a few that still feel that it should be a man's position. I will say that in the travels and working with Tana Chiefs these last 4 months, the presidency position is just a 24-hour day job, and the travel that's involved in it is just unsurmountable. I think it would be very difficult for a woman with a family to handle that kind of pressure right now, you know, until unless it's a very unique person who within the family, you know, the husband can care for the children while they're gone. Because the Indian women across the country, their number one priority is a family unit, a strong family unit that remains top. And if it can't be resolved with the family to care for the children, you know, the husband or immediate family, then the woman will step aside until that gets resolved. Because we have always felt that a closeness, you know, to our children. And I've not seen that diminish.
It must be kind of a hard balancing act then for somebody like yourself who was very active in the, you know, the Tana Chiefs and in your village and in Fairbanks area, to balance the activities with the family, if you want to do both.
Yes, it is. It's extremely difficult. I think that we have to support and have our families know that, you know, we care about them just as much, and that we devote as much time as we can to them, and that they still are our priority. And yet not give any less of ourselves to our responsibilities as like president of our village corporation or on a regional board or, you know, in our working, our occupation. It becomes very difficult at times, and you wonder, what am I doing this for?
That was going to be my next question.
What am I doing this for? That'd be a little bit hard to answer. I see a lot of good things for the future for our children. I'm just anxious for all of these choices to be made available to them and make it easier on them in the next generation. We keep talking about our next generation is going to be our salvation, and I think we've said this for, well, two generations that I know of, and we're still talking now about, you know, our second and third generation coming up. But I do firmly believe that, and if it weren't for that fact, I don't think that I would give this kind of time.
Georgiana Lincoln, Director of Native Services of the Tanana Chiefs Conference. For Chinook Patterns, I'm Paula Schiller, and Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.